The next U.S. president will likely be forced to answer a critical question. Will U.S. healthcare be government-run, or will Americans be asked to choose their insurance plans and medical care from private firms? Healthcare is one of the crucial issues for the electorate in 2008, and a new book by Harvard Business School professor Regina Herzlinger called Who Killed Consumer-Driven Cure weighs in on the debate. It's published by McGraw-Hill, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Professor Herzlinger to my show today. Hello.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Ordinary Americans in recent YouTube presidential candidate debate focused their concerns about our failing healthcare system. One of the many videos posted was from Kim, who said, I'm 36 years old and hope to be a future breast cancer survivor. Like millions of Americans, I've gone for years without health insurance. What would you, as president, do to make low-cost or free preventative medicine available for everybody in the country? How would you have answered her?
Well, I think it's awful that in this country, which is the richest in the world, probably the richest country in history, we have more than 40 million people who don't have health insurance, and many of them are poor people. They just can't afford it. So clearly what we need to do in this great charitable country is cough up the money so these people can be insured. Now, insurance, however, does not always cover preventive care. Lots of health insurance is procedural. It covers doctor's visits, surgeries, tests, but it doesn't really focus on promoting health. So I think we would need different kinds of health insurance policies that would ensure that people get the health promotion they need.
Now, not all the candidates for president have put together healthcare proposals, but I'm sure you've looked over the ones that have been made available so far. How would you describe their plans?
It's really interesting. The plans do not all call for universal insurance. Surprisingly, Barack Obama does not require everybody be insured. But what they all do have in common, and it's kind of astonishing on both the Democratic and Republican side, is that individuals would buy their health insurance. These proposals would not dismantle the existing employer-based health insurance system, which is how many Americans get their health insurance. But for the uninsured, they would open up individual insurance markets so that people can choose the health insurance that best meets their needs.
So none of them are proposing anything like what we see in most European countries.
Correct. None of them are proposing the kind of system. It's important to be precise because different countries have different mixes of systems. But none of them are proposing the kind of system that the UK and Canada has.
Well, you don't like that system.
I don't say I wouldn't like it. I love the universal coverage in these systems. What I deplore in them is they're very, it's very important to control their costs. And the easy way to control costs, but the cruel way to control costs, is to ration health care for the sick. So this woman you mentioned at YouTube who had breast cancer, there are 20,000 people who have cancer in the UK and who died of it who would have lived in the US. In both Canada and the UK, if you're litigious, if you're connected, if you're powerful, you go to the head of the list. Indeed, one Canadian premier who had a melanoma, which is a potentially scary skin cancer, he left Canada and got treatment in the U.S. So for the sick, they're not great.
Well, I just heard a report this morning on NPR. Well, I guess it wasn't NPR. It was on the BBC about people going to India, and they're going to some other countries because even in the United States, the feeling is that you wait forever to get to a specialist unless you are on the verge of death in many cases. And sometimes you don't even know. You might have a serious condition, but you can't get anybody to see you. It might be worth it to fly to India or to a few other countries that are now offering instant health care.
Yeah. The medical tourism, as it's called, is mostly aimed at the uninsured. And countries like Britain, in fact, use India as a kind of bench to provide specialized health care that they don't have the capacity for. But in my book, I focus on a character who is fully insured. He has end-stage renal disease. He needs a kidney transplant, and the insurer screws around, and in the real-life version of this story, which happened with Kaiser Permanente, a big HMO out in California, some of the people who were waiting for kidney transplants were advised to go to India. That's terrible.
My guest is Regina Herzlinger. Her book, Who Killed Healthcare? America's $2 trillion medical problem and the consumer-driven cure, is published by McGraw-Hill. This is WNYC at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, in Michael Moore's Sicko, he also talks about Kaiser Permanente, and his solution is something like the British system, or I think he probably loves the French system the most. I get the feeling you would prefer something like what Rudy Giuliani is suggesting here. Is that true?
The Michael Moore deification of the French system is kind of ironic.
Well, I've been to France and got sick, and they just took me into the hospital, and they sent me home. Yeah. In Germany, I had a problem. I fell off a bicycle and cracked open my head, and they gave me all the tests that would be necessary, kept me overnight, gave me better food than I've had in a couple of restaurants, and they did send me a bill. It was for, I think, something like $800. Well, right. In this country, that thing would have cost me $10,000.
Yeah, well, you know, the German citizens and the French citizens subsidized you because the underlying costs are much greater than $800. And it shows that those are systems that are not used to billing out their cost. It was a nice and generous thing to do. But the French taxpayers and the German taxpayers paid for that generosity. The French system is not a single-payer system. It's a mixed public-private kind of system. And so that's what we have. We have a mixed private-public system. So as an old academic, I would say that he didn't get that right. The systems that he really wants to emulate are the ones in the UK and Canada, where the government is the only payer. I think the European country that offers us a great alternative is Switzerland. And in the Swiss system, everybody is insured, except they buy their own health insurance. They have a lot of choice of health insurance. They don't just have one choice of a government-led system. If you're poor in Switzerland, in most of the cantons, you don't get shoved into a program like Medicaid. Medicaid is better than not being insured, but in some states, up to 40% of the doctors won't accept Medicaid patients. So they're treated like second-class people for no reason other than being poor. In Switzerland, they get enough money and they go and buy health insurance for themselves. Everybody's insured. Switzerland has a great healthcare system. People go from all over the world to come to the Swiss system. It costs 40% less than ours. I think that's where we're heading.
Well, I'm not sure I understand how it works and how it's different from any other. Can you lay it out for us?
Sure. So, first of all, it's universal, so everybody has to be insured. You are required to buy health insurance
even
in Switzerland.
Even if I'm below the poverty level?
Now, if you're below the poverty level, you are required. But they don't put you into a program like Medicaid. They give you enough money so that you can go out and buy health insurance just like everybody else. There are 87 different health insurance companies in tiny Switzerland, and they offer some very innovative insurance policies. For example, you asked earlier about health promotion. There's a 5-year policy in Switzerland. You sign up for 5 years. they measure your health. If you're that healthy or healthier 5 years from that, from the beginning, you get half your money back. In Massachusetts, that would mean I would get about $35,000 back for staying healthy.
It's kind of like when car insurance companies will give you some kind of a lower rate because you've been a safe driver.
Yes, and it's a tremendous incentive and reward for staying healthy, for leading the kind of lifestyle that would enable you to stay healthy. Of course, if you're genetically ill, that's right. Factored in.
Cancer and things like that are not things that we can prevent ourselves from having. But you're talking about obesity and the things that might
smoking,
come out of that.
Things that are indisputably injurious to your health and controllable.
Now, one of the problems people say in this country is that with all the different insurance companies out there, they're for-profit organizations.
Yeah.
That is an incentive to them to not really provide the kind of health care that's necessary. Their incentive is to deny us.
Absolutely.
And to keep the money and use it for their, you know, to pay their executives.
They're shareholders. They are companies, and their obligation, if they're ethically run, is to do the right thing and maximize returns for their shareholders.
And that doesn't happen in Switzerland?
The reason it doesn't happen is it's consumers who are doing the buying. In our system, it's our bosses who buy health insurance on our behalf. So Harvard University takes $10,000 to $15,000 of my salary, uses it to buy my health insurance. I may perceive it as being free, but it's not free. It's foregone salary. I don't have the power to hold that insurer's feet to the fire. If I bought that insurance, they would pay a heck of a lot of attention to me. Look at other consumer markets. Look at the computer market. Complicated good that's gone down sharply in price and improved sharply in quality because consumers buy it and they keep shopping for the best value.
So you're suggesting a free market approach. Now, this is kind of like what Rudy Giuliani has proposed. He says he thinks a $15,000 tax deduction should be put in place so people can buy their own health insurance plans and invest any leftover money into health savings or retirement accounts. Is that an approach you like?
It's partially an approach I like. It's certainly, right now, people permit their employers to buy their health insurance because an employer can use pre-tax money to buy health insurance.
But isn't also the feeling that if you're buying for a large number, you're actually, it's a saving as opposed to each person doing it individually?
Right.
Cuts down on an awful lot of the bureaucracy, doesn't it?
So the tax credit that Giuliani is proposing would make it possible for individuals to use, in effect, pre-tax money to buy health insurance. So they would no longer need their employers to buy it for them or get locked into jobs they don't want to have. Now, what about the employer's ability to pull? So General Electric has hundreds of thousands of workers. It can pool the risk among them. Well, an insurance company can pool that risk just as well. You don't need an employer to create a pool. The problem with the Giuliani plan is that it doesn't require everybody to have health insurance. And the reason that's a problem is, let's say I get $10,000 back from Harvard University and I go to buy health insurance. If I had end-stage renal disease, it would cost me $65,000 to buy it. I couldn't possibly afford to buy it with $10,000. If everybody were in the market, then the people who are healthy could implicitly be subsidizing the sick. If health insurance is voluntary, only sick people will sign up, and it will not be affordable for them.
Paul Krugman points out in today's New York Times that Rudy Giuliani's plan is quite vague. Nothing's been put on papers yet. And Professor Krugman suggests that he may never put it on paper because it serves his purpose to remain vague. while being able to criticize the Democrats' plans as socialized medicine.
It's going to be an interesting political debate. Health care is clearly the number one domestic topic, or it's tied with immigration. And it's been of concern to the American people for a long period of time.
Although we go through waves, don't we? There was a before the Clinton plan was proposed, it was the big topic, and then it died, I guess, with the failure of that.
Right.
Now it's back because nothing has been resolved.
Well, it's killing the American economy. That's why it's back. The business community is pushing it. But the presidential candidates, they're like deer in the headlights when it comes to health care. It's tremendously complicated. You can fall off the cliff at any moment. Even politicians as astute as the Clintons fell off on the health care topic. What's going to make it, what's going to force Giuliani and others to be much more specific? It is the presence of Hillary Clinton in this race. Senator Clinton, she bombed out the first time she went on health care, but she's a learner and she's very smart.
She hasn't come up with a new plan.
She is thinking about a new plan. I would think that Senator Clinton will push health care. She will push Giuliani and Romney and the others to be very specific. And the reason she'll push them is she is tremendously well-versed in this subject, and it's a woman's issue. It's a natural issue for her. So perhaps Mayor Giuliani will stay vague. I don't think so. I think he'll be forced to become very explicit.
We have to take a little break, but when I come back, I want to talk about President Bush's similar proposal and some other matters as we continue this conversation with Regina Herzlinger, who's the Nancy R. McPherson Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School, has also sat on the boards of directors of dozens of nonprofit and business healthcare organizations, and was elected one of the 100 most powerful people in healthcare by Modern Healthcare. Her book, Who Killed Healthcare? America's $2 Trillion Medical Problem and the Consumer-Driven Cure, is published by McGraw-Hill. Stay with us. We're back with Professor Regina Herzlinger. Her book, Who Killed Healthcare? America's $2 Trillion Medical Problem and the Consumer-Driven Cure, published by McGraw-Hill. A listener writes in, your guest just gave the best argument against the Swiss system. Sure, if we could be insured by the Swiss, maybe people could afford the health insurance. In America, the insurance is so costly, many people, except for the wealthiest, like our president, vice president, and Congress, cannot afford to buy it. Perhaps your guest could tell us who in America would insure people for the $800 tax credit as proposed by her and Giuliani.
The Giuliani tax credit is $15,000, not $800. I'm not sure where that number came from. I think to insure...
The president said $7,500. Is the same pretty much the same plan?
It's a similar kind of plan, but the magnitude, somehow the listener got the number a little mixed up. It's quite an order of magnitude different. I think we will need to pay more in taxes to insure the uninsured, and I think many people will want to do that. The real question is, who's going to run this healthcare system? Is it going to be consumers? Is it going to be employers? Or is it going to be the government?
A caller who says he lived in Switzerland with a Swiss wife says the per capita income is much higher and they can afford for the tax rates to pay for the medical care.
The Swiss health care system is much cheaper than ours. It's 40% lower cost than ours. That's $800 billion lower than ours. So the fact that the Swiss are wealthy and they are wealthier on the average than Americans, sadly, has nothing to do with our health care expenditures.
Is the big problem HMOs? Because I remember that things were a lot nicer before Richard Nixon and HMOs.
Yeah.
And suddenly everything changed, and now there is no doctor. who I've spoken to, who has a nice thing to say about HMOs. They complain constantly.
Do you remember the murder on the Orient Express, that Agatha Christie? So some guy dies. Who killed him?
Yeah.
Everybody on the train.
They all stabbed him.
The insurers, geez, they're no saints. They certainly have made it very difficult for many people to get the health care that they paid for. But the hospitals, they're not angels either. In many parts of the country, hospitals have merged. And I'll put merge in quotes, they formed oligopolies or monopolies. There's no competition. Prices have gone up while quality has deteriorated. McKinsey estimates that we spend $500 trillion more than countries of similar wealth on health care. 80% of that is due to the inefficiency of our hospital system. We have great people in these hospitals, but their costs are killing healthcare as well.
In your book, you have chapters organized by the killers of healthcare, as you call them. The killer number one is the health insurers, number two, the general hospital, three, the employers, four, the U.S. Congress, and five, academics.
Right.
And now they're not all in concert with each other. Each one of them is responsible for another terrible aspect of what's happening.
Yeah, you know, we've turned over $2.2 trillion. That's how much we spend on healthcare. Ultimately, it's our money. It comes from our taxes, comes from our foregone salary. We've given it to these people, and we haven't held them accountable. We said, do with it what you will. Well, they each do what's good for them, not what's good for us.
Now, what has happened? Because I can remember back to the days when my health care was paid for by my employer,
right,
the same as it is today,
right,
but there were no HMOs. And I pretty much had decent health care, and I didn't spend a heck of a lot of money on it. I didn't have these constant things come in the mail that say, well, we've denied 90% of the bill, and you owe your doctor $5,000. We've paid him $25.38.
Right. So the one of the key issues was, as the HMOs got more and more powerful, they would go to hospitals and they'd say, cut your prices, or we're going to go, instead of going to you, Hospital A, we're going to go to Hospital B. Well, in retaliation, the hospitals merged. So what we had were big buyers who were mainly interested in cutting prices and rationing care, and big suppliers who no longer had competition. Things deteriorated. Plus, the buyer of healthcare is an HR person in a company. They're very good people. They're well-intended. But how the heck did they know what you want versus what I want? So we all wind up with something that nobody wants.
But we have a message sent in by email from Wick Smith. He says, I have private health insurance, and I don't sense any particular responsiveness. My wife and I pay almost $1,000 a month, and I'm sure that if and when I need it, I will discover how uncovered I actually am.
Yeah. I imagine that this gentleman buys it individually when
he's not doing it through an
employer. He's not doing it through a corporation. Right now, the individual market is not a very good market because there's so few people in it. But most of the markets for goods and services in the United States are individual markets. We buy cars, we buy clothing, we buy housing, we buy food. All these things have gotten better and cheaper. So when there's a broad-based individual market, right now there are only about 18 million individuals in the market. They discipline the providers. I'm very sorry that he is in that situation.
But since he's really, to some degree, doing what you're saying, why isn't it working?
Because it's too small a market. 18 million people spread over 50 states is a very small population. If it were 290 million people, controlling the health insurance would be a very different response.
What about the U.S. Congress and the academics? Ooh. How do they play a major part?
Oh, the U.S. Congress. End-stage renal disease is paid for by Medicare. It's the only disease where no matter how old you are, Medicare pays the
bill. So if you need kidney dialysis, you are assured that you're going to have it. But if you have a cancer problem or you have you're not going to get your chemotherapy paid.
So we can look at how well Congress manages end-stage renal disease. And Congress has cooked up a recipe for how to treat people who need dialysis. They've said you're going to be dialyzed 3 times a week. You're going to get a certain amount of a drug called Epogen. You're going to get so much testing. You're going to get so much health promotion. The congressional recipe is a cookie cutter. So if you and I had kidney disease, we would get the same treatment. We may require very different treatment, but it would be the same because the Congress controls it. So I have a passage in the book where one senator, now don't get me wrong, he's a very smart man, but this senator is pushing for a higher hematocrit level. He wants a higher iron level in people who have end-stage renal disease. Now, what does he know about iron levels? He's a lawyer. He's a smart man, but he's not your doctor or my doctor.
But some doctor got to him and told him that he should change this.
It may be that some doctor got to him, or it may be that the pharmaceutical company that manufactures the drug that raises iron level in people who have dialysis got to a number of people in the Congress. In other words, medicine becomes politicized when it's under the control of the Congress.
Well, didn't it become politicized when we chose renal disease and nothing else to even be dealt with in this way? I'm interested in the drug aspect. A friend found himself in Europe with a leaky medical thing. And it was for his eye pressure, and he didn't know what to do. He called his pharmacy back here and said, could you FedEx something? They said, well, we're not sure we can get it to you on time. Why don't you just go into a local pharmacy and ask for it? He said, well, it's a prescription drug. They said, well, the French aren't like the Americans. Right. Went in, they pulled it out of a drawer, gave it to him. He came back and he said, well, I paid 17 euros for this. And his pharmacist said, oh, gee, I pay $150 for that same thing when I have to buy it wholesale.
Yeah. There's no question that the American drug users of scripts, doctor-prescribed medications, are subsidizing the rest of the world. We can't continue to do that. On the other hand, we do a lot more R&D in the United States in the pharmaceutical industry and have the benefits of that research in the U.S., not only the medical benefits, but the financial benefits.
But aren't most of the big pharmaceutical companies foreign?
No. There are a few Swiss. There's some German and French, but most of them are American, and most of the biotechnology industry. Now, I went to MIT. I love technology, but it's hugely promising. It will really promise to cure diseases. It's in the U.S.
What have the academics done to kill our healthcare system?
Well, the academics are very convinced of their own genius, and what they would like is to run the healthcare system. And because they're so smart, and
you're an academic.
I am an academic, but I'm a different kind of academic. I'm a business school academic. So I'm different in other ways, as you could tell from my voice. So these academics have gone down on their fellow physicians. And if you pick up medical journals, there are typically a number of articles over the course of a year about how terrible doctors are. Not every doctor is an angel. Not every doctor is wonderful. But this is a relentless stream. And in response to that, they have initiated things that tell doctors how to practice medicine. Some of these dicta are very helpful, like telling a heart attack victim to stop smoking or to take aspirin. But some of them are cookie-cutter kinds of medicine, and we're not cookie-cutter. We don't understand human biology well enough for this. So a lot of physicians are either deserting medicine or they're not even becoming doctors. The number of applicants to medical school has dropped by 20% over the past decade. It's horrifying. Medicine has become increasingly an unpopular and undesirable occupation.
So we're importing doctors from other parts of the world, nurses and doctors. In a recent article for the Washington Post, you wrote, the American Medical Association, which receives $286 million in revenue, received in revenue last year to protect the profession, has served physicians poorly. Why has the AMA been letting its members down?
The AMA does not focus, like many organizations, does not focus on the big picture. The big picture is we want smart, creative people to be doctors because medicine right now is much more art than science. You want some really great artists to be drawn into medicine. But as medicine becomes increasingly driven by pay-for-performance kind of dicta, as the compensation of doctors is increasingly scrutinized, it's gone down on an inflation-adjusted basis. People are saying, you know what? I can be a biotechnology researcher. I can look into nanotechnology. I can be an entrepreneur. I can be a journalist. I'm going to give medicine a pass. The AMA is constantly involved with little battles with Medicare to get more money for some particular group. It's missing the forest for the trees.
In Massachusetts, there's been a drive under a new law to get health insurance coverage to everyone in the state by July 1st. Did it work?
There are two parts to the question. Did it work? Well, there are fewer people who are uninsured in Massachusetts. That's great.
That's your home state.
My home state.
And
that's
do you like great. This plan?
The plan is half empty or half full. I think it's half full. It's half full because it requires that everybody be insured. That's wonderful. It uses about $1 billion that used to go to hospitals to ostensibly provide care for the uninsured. Instead, it gives that money directly to the uninsured so they can buy health insurance. But the insurance policies are designed by the legislature, and they can only be purchased in a government-run store. So, understandably, they're hugely expensive. Plus, insurance is not the solution to make our healthcare system cheaper. Unless we get the hospitals to slim down, it will never be affordable. So,
but the hospitals are suffering, aren't they? And they claim that they're not getting, you know, many bills go unpaid because they are often the medical practitioners of last resort.
Yeah, wish it were so. Would be wonderful. There are some hospitals that are enormously charitable, but all too many hospitals, if you're uninsured, you're tossed out the door if it's apparent that you can't pay the bill. Or if you can pay the bill, you get charged the very highest prices, the rack rate that they charge anybody. I'm not getting out my tissues for them.
Regina Herzlinger is the Nancy R. McPherson Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book, one of a number of books now about the crisis in American healthcare, is called Who Killed Healthcare? America's $2 trillion Medical Problem and the Consumer-Driven Cure. It is published by McGraw-Hill. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, we will learn how economics can help you deal with your dentist, survive your next business meeting, and even fall in love. Also a celebration of the immigrant experience that's been described as Pynchon crossed with Steinbeck and painted by Dali, plus how the Marshall Plan helped save Europe. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Fiona Rigby, Brad Ludlow, Angie Sheldon, and Scott Goldberg. Kim Gittleson produced the underappreciated series. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.